Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because I think, which you highlight a lot in your book, that I don't think making out that sex work is just the same as everything else is helpful. Because obviously it's more intimate than most forms of labour.
And also there are some people, actually, who, like, it's like that thing with some of the arguments, if you take them logically, it means, well, why isn't it advertised in the job centre?
Yeah. Which you point out in the book, that obviously that, like, logic saying that people should be forced to do...
Yeah.
I think you use the phone...
Yeah, phone sex, but there are certain things, like, there, some people do have a really emotional connections to sex.
Exactly, yeah. And I, like...
Yeah.
There are some people, I think, who probably can just, like, switch off and have sex with people they're not attracted to.
Hello, and welcome to Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today I'm joined by Alex Faes-Bryce, the founding CEO of National Ugly Mugs, an award-winning charity which supports sex workers throughout the UK when they become victims of crime and advocates for their human rights. Today we're going to be talking about the gender disparity in selling sex, the control zone at the Holbeck estate, feminism, and the secret diary of a cool girl. Someone I interviewed for this, for the podcast, talks about that and just they absolutely disassociate, as in it's already there, the disassociation, in a relationship or not.
Yeah. Exactly. And but obviously loads of people can't do that.
No.
And so then to force them to do that as a job.
Yeah. Also some people, like a couple of my friends who thought they could and then couldn't.
Yeah. Yes. That was an interesting example as well. Mm. And it was from Secret Diary of a Cool Girl.
Just interrupting the podcast to clarify here, we're talking about The Secret Diary of a Cool Girl, a very successful comedy show in the UK starring Billy Piper. It was based on the blogs and then books of Belle de Jour, the pseudonym of Dr. Brooke Magnanti, who was working as an escort at the time. Dr. Brooke Magnanti has also written her own books now, which are very fascinating, about sex and statistics.
Which is interesting because... I didn't watch the show, but I've read some of the books, and Brooke is a friend of mine. Really.
Yes, she's amazing, isn't she? Yeah. Actually, what it does, episode by episode, is tick off lots of things that actually do happen.
Right. Okay.
So there is an episode where Billy Piper's character, the cool girl, is hired for a party, and she's with another woman who are both hired to work, and it becomes really clear that they're in danger.
Yeah.
But it's all dealt with in a really silly way.
Right, okay.
So they kind of fight and escape, but actually what it's showing is the reality of being hired, being very far away, getting your danger, all of your alerts go off of this, I'm not safe, there's so many more men than there are of us. But she escapes out of a window and everyone's fine, and... There's another episode where they kind of deal with, like, disability, having or a virginity.
Right.
There's all these kind of things where you go, well, these are all actual people's stories and experiences, but it's a comedy show.
Yeah, I see. I didn't realise it was like, because my sister, it was a big show that she loved, and my boyfriend is American and has probably been in the UK for about 7 years.
Yeah.
But he'd watched that before he came to the UK, along with other strange British shows like The Vicar of Dibley.
Yes.
And had this really skewed view of what... Don't combine the two. Secret Diary of a Cool Girl could be very different, but
It's like that's town and country.
And actually when we first lived together, it was in the country, so I think it was. And I guess maybe culturally, trying to think about it, like, maybe it being a bit comedic might have been the only way to kind of
absolutely
get what could be a hard-hitting, like, I always think Queer as Folk was like a seminal TV show for me, but that was kind of a bit ridiculous and comedic.
Yes.
And whereas actually it was some quite serious, I mean, I think one of the main characters died on like the fourth episode or something.
Wow.
But
okay.
It was still done in this kind of comedic way, because it's the only way of getting
sometimes it's how that you make something more mainstream. Is that people don't want to be confronted, they want to watch something while they eat their dinner. And there is the thing about TV in general, actually, it's such a wide audience. I think with lots more channels and Netflix now, stuff can be made that's more kind of for a subculture.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you get that. Yeah, it's very interesting. All of that in general. So the reason we originally met is because you have worked with Ugly Mugs.
Yeah.
And I think, like lots of people, that's something I'd never heard of because I've never sold sex.
Yeah.
So can I ask you some questions about
it? Yeah, go for it.
So when was it founded? When did it start?
So the actual organisation I ran was founded in 2012.
Yeah.
But that was based on work that Australian sex workers did. So they used to share like handwritten notes about dangerous individuals as like a sort of peer-led, you know, safety mechanism.
Yes.
And they'd like they'd copy out these notes hundreds of times. And I've actually seen
hundreds of times.
Yeah, and pass them out among sex workers.
Oh, so it wouldn't be just to give it to one person. Everyone, you try and say.
Yeah, yes. So it would be like, you know, a description of this guy. He was dodgy. He was tall, red hair, whatever.
Yeah.
And they recopy them out and hand them to all the other sex workers. But I've actually seen some of the early notes because there was a British academic who went over and did some work with them and then brought them back. So she's actually got some, we call them alerts. So she's got some original alerts.
Yeah.
But the organisation I set up was... founded in 2012.
Yes. And it wasn't handwritten notes.
No, we did have the power of the internet then. But, but it was kind of still fairly, although it was digital, it was still fairly simple. It was like we used to send emails, text messages to sex workers saying, you know, there's a guy in Manchester, you know, looks like this. We wouldn't ever give a name, but actually the name wouldn't help so much.
Because there's a legal issue, isn't there? Because the only reason... I say that is because we tried to unionise as comedians, and one of the difficulties that we had is that it's very similar to lots of people's employment, but people don't want to be seen as troublemakers. Yeah. They don't want to complain when something's happened, and sometimes when something really bad has happened. So say, for instance, if someone was raped by a promoter at a gig, you don't also want everyone to know that. Mm-hmm. But what you want to do is protect other workers. Yeah. And we thought it'd be really great because then all we do is just have like an email thing.
Yeah,
and you just send an email around and go, so-and-so's a rapist. Yeah. And found out you're not allowed to do that.
So I think sometimes we probably went as far, you know, as close. We did have sort of perpetrators contact us quite a lot saying, oh, I think this alert that I've seen, you know, describes
me.
And we basically, you know, we'd have to get legal advice and stuff, but it never amounted to anything.
Yes.
But yeah, so the organisation's still going. I was CEO for like 6 years and kind of set it up. So.
And it still exists. And that is a way of people being able to warn other people. And it just gives people a bit more, people selling sex, a bit more information to feel qualified to go, oh, hang on, I'd be extra careful about you because you've got the exact description of someone.
Exactly. And like, I mean, sometimes it was... like there'd be incidents that the police would tell us about. We were kind of distant from the police. You know, a lot of the time police were the problem.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because someone who doesn't have any involvement or know anyone selling sex or thinks that they don't wouldn't presume that.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, sometimes it would be like just police approach would cause problems.
Yes.
Like police would be, you know, driving sex workers underground, you know, like... operations to kind of reduce sex work in a particular area. That was a problem. But obviously, you know, their intentions were probably good, although sometimes it was because they wanted to, like, make an area seem more middle class and lovely and things.
Yeah.
But sometimes it would be, like, we dealt with a couple of, well, say dealt with, we were involved in a couple of cases where sex workers, and I think there was a similar example in your book, but sex workers were asked to... perform a sex act with a police officer to avoid arrest.
There's a huge amount of hypocrisy, and actually the trouble with how vulnerable sex workers are is that kind of instance of arrest or this or there was a term I was reading, something like the idea of like a freebie.
Yeah.
Like because it's transactional then suddenly, rather than it being a theft or coercion or a crime, which I consider it is a crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And that's, I mean, that's
what an abuse of power that is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that sex workers have to put up with all the time because their work is kind of quasi criminal.
Yes.
Is that people will push the boundaries and say, oh, you know, I didn't ejaculate, so I'll give you 80 quid instead of 100 and things like that.
Yeah.
Which you wouldn't like go to, I don't know, Starbucks and say, oh, well, I wasn't quite...
Did finish my coffee.
Yeah, I didn't finish my coffee.
I got too much caffeine today. I think I'll have my £3
back.
Well, that's the really interesting discussion around like the it being work.
Yeah.
That when, so regardless of any morality, once that's accepted, then you can see how ridiculous that situation would be. Kind of someone refusing to pay.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that happens. And it's difficult because like I've obviously toyed in my head of whether I think a blanket sex work is work is maybe problematic.
Mm.
But for most of, like I always kind of in my head think there's, you know, maybe 10% of sex workers who are very sex positive and actually enjoy having sex, or maybe maybe even less actually, maybe 5%.
Mm.
And you probably spoke to like Charlotte Rose, for example.
Yes, I did,
Who's like... You know, I mean, she's brilliant. I'm friends with her, but she probably doesn't have the same experience in most senses because she loves so being in the limelight.
I interviewed her for the podcast, and actually what's amazing about her, so it's not just that she's very positive about sex work, she's like an ambassador almost, but she also talked about losing her job, having her daughter taken away from her. Yeah. So within that, even someone, and she's also so aware of privilege, which actually everyone I spoke to in terms of the spectrum of sex work is in a privileged position.
Yeah, totally.
What's also clear is like everywhere else, the people you hear from are the people the system is working for best.
Yeah, that's
never
true.
Never the people who are really being oppressed or screwed over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, and I guess National Limos, it was almost skewed the other way in that, I can't remember the actual stats, but a higher proportion, maybe 60% of the crimes that we dealt with, so where sex workers were the victim, it was like street-based sex workers, so who were, you know, probably sex working to feed drug and alcohol addictions, or if not, it was because of poverty, destitution.
Yes.
And then sometimes we'd get people, you know, the term sort of, in inverted commas, high-end, who'd been raped or whatever, but the majority of sex workers in the middle, so what I think of about sort of 80% of sex workers, it's kind of, they are doing it because it's probably better than working, you know, like 1 hour of sex work is the equivalent of 14 hours in a crap job. Mm. And they might not enjoy sex work. You know, most probably don't.
But it's over quickly.
Like their clients, but it's over quickly. And then if they're disabled, if they're a single mother, and then...
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's a kind of feminized job, because the workplace is, you know, offers fewer opportunities for women, especially if they're carers, mothers, etc.
Well, exactly, so. that people actually don't have the time, or the thing with childcare in this country is that it costs so much money for a woman to go out to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And so literally their hands are tied in terms of what they can afford to do. And the options, it is feminized. Do you know anything about the kind of the statistics about men who sell sex? Because that's something I found impossible to kind of. I also haven't talked to anyone who pays for sex, really, apart from Charlotte Rose talked about it a little bit.
Right. Okay.
But it was also, I was just so shy of speaking to those people, because I think that's when I think my prejudice and bias would come up too much.
Yeah.
I had a man emailing me from Germany about how great their legal system was. And it was great that he was willing to talk to me, but he was and I just, every time he told me how great it was to pay for sex, and he was talking as in like he pays for it and how great it is for the woman also. He had that thing of patting himself on the back, like, I'm helping these girls through school and I'm helping single mums. And I thought, I couldn't face to face listen to someone talking about it.
I don't think I could, because that would really kind of annoy me. And I think there are some cases where, like, you get there's a film, I think it's called Scarlet Road, which is an Australian sex worker in, I think, Victoria or one of the states of Australia where they've got parts of it decriminalised. Yes. And she, the sex worker, it's about her basically and her clients. She specialises in like disabled clients. And there was one which, one of the sort of things that featured on the movie was a disabled guy who I can't remember what his disability was, but basically he couldn't really talk, you know, he couldn't go out and meet people, and his like elderly, quite conservative with a small c parents had arranged for his like 40th birthday party some kind of intimate contact, which it's a bit of a mind.
So had he asked for it? Was that clear?
I don't think he was
able.
I don't know if he was able to articulate it in kind of words.
Oh, so you mean he'll get an erection?
Yeah, he was definitely wanting it. And, and the, I can't remember the name of the sex worker, but she, I actually met her when she was doing the premiere over here, but she felt like she was doing a kind of caring role in a sense.
Yeah.
And it was quite sweet, but again, it's like, is this kind of idea of a right to sex, which I don't really.
It's again, everything brings up a whole new bunch of questions, doesn't it? Of like, where does that lead to? And also, so it's something that I talked to Eliza about, but we never ever would see it the other way around. How we deal with female sexuality would never be. She couldn't talk, but she definitely.
I know.
Yeah, she wanted to be fingered. So I tell you what we did. We got someone round.
Maybe I'm really remembering that badly. Maybe he could articulate. That's what he wanted. But but that's totally true. Like you'd never think.
I think you'd really judge the parents in a completely different way. I think there are people who can liberally understand the physical need for contact and to go, actually, if it's completely impossible as a loving parent. There's that reality show or that conversation show that I'm pretty sure Julie Bindle talks about it in her book, but I'm pretty sure Julie Bindle was the guest where it was a mother and son and she'd kind of opened a brothel for her son. Yeah. Yeah. And the elders are clapping like, this is so great.
Yeah. I think there was this, I was a guest on that. There was this terrible like ITV daytime. I can't even remember what it was, but they basically had three episodes of this discussion, political discussion show, which was a bit like The Big Questions on Sunday, but on like a Wednesday afternoon on ITV. And one of the first topics that it was prostitution, and I was a guest, and Julie Bindle was a guest. I think this woman was a guest. And it was, I mean, it was really awful show.
Yeah.
And they got rid of it after about four episodes. But I was on one of the sort of three or four episodes. But I think that featured on that.
So in terms of like debating, have you ever had that kind of position? Because obviously Julie Bindle is someone who has, she's an activist.
Yeah.
And also she works with a lot of people exiting prostitution, people who are survivors would be the phrase that would be used.
Yeah.
But in that way, she's quite in opposition to other kind of people who are just trying to say these people are trying to earn their living or wants it to be decriminalised, for instance. I don't think Julie Bindle does want that.
No. So I have, like, I've been, one thing that kind of came with, and I'd always try and give sex workers like ECP the platform. I would never kind of, me as a bloke who's running an organisation, would never like take that platform. But sometimes because of, we knew a lot about kind of violence and things that happened to sex workers and rights, and we worked with police and things like that. I would be on a platform with those. And I did do numerous debates sometimes with Julie. And I guess for me, it was always a bit like, I think maybe a journey that you, so cliche, a journey that you went on with your book, that you had like your own views. And I sort of have my own views.
Yes.
But ultimately, I don't know, it's almost like you just put aside your... I feel like we've got a duty to put aside our own views and listen to the majority of sex workers.
Yes.
And that's kind of what I did. So that's why I came... I mean, my organised... So National Women's was set up from a network of support services. So the network of support services called the UK Network of Sex Work Projects had a position because they sort of surveyed their members that decriminalisation was the way forward. So I came to the organisation, the organisation had a position, but I became like a really strong vocal advocate for decriminalisation, and I work with police forces to change their practices to move away from arresting sex workers. And sometimes, I mean, I'd get quite angry, you know, and in meetings and with police. I think...
Did the police feel that their work, when they were kind of arresting sex workers or making their lives more difficult or driving them underground, do you believe that they did think they were making the world better?
I think one of the challenges is that I guess it's kind of competing pressures or commitments.
Okay.
So like police would get, and this is kind of empathising them a little bit, they would sometimes get, like in your reference in your book, Leeds Holbeck area.
Yes.
So that started, and that's what they call the managed area. But that started because there were lots of sex workers working in a very residential area.
Yeah.
And there was almost like vigilante action against them from local people, like really angry, aggressive.
Because people do tend to hate any visibility. I mean, there's something going on in Sheffield when they're trying to close a strip club, which is obviously a different kind of sexual behaviour. But so people see it as a sign of a degraded area, a bad area,
property
immoral.
Prices. Yeah.
And then they all have worries about children, teenagers, children seeing that these behaviours.
Yeah. And so that was happening, and there was quite a lot of litter, like sex litter, some of it, you know.
Sex litter.
Yeah, like condoms.
Condoms,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And, and so the police and local agencies, and National Women's were kind of involved as like a partner with the local agency, tried to say, the police were getting, I think it was something like 60 calls a day.
Wow.
About complaints.
Yes.
So not actual crimes against sex. Well, there might have been kind of antisocial behaviour against sex workers, but not actual perpetrators.
And in terms of the antisocial behaviour towards the sex workers, are we talking kind of like physical or like shouting, abusive kind of things?
A bit of both, but I think it's probably more abuse and them being like abused when they're going into shops and things like that, and drivers walking past throwing things.
Yeah.
So the police and the local authority and BASIS, the sort of local charity.
Yeah.
So I came together and National Women's were supporting it kind of strategic level to be like, we need to move this away, and the only way of like encouraging sex workers to work in another area would be to say, if you go back to this residential area, we might arrest you, but if you go to this other area, which is actually nearby, then we won't. Because if you just said you need to go to this area, then they'd be like, well, why should we? The clients come here.
Yeah.
So that was a way of moving it away. And it was a really, there was loads of opposition to it, as you would understand. But essentially, it was just a really pragmatic, sensible approach. Mm. And I went quite early on, myself and actually a Tory politician in London Assembly, who's got a really positive, progressive view on sex work.
Okay, who's that?
Andrew Boff.
Okay.
He wrote a report about the Olympics, which brought him, the Olympics where they tried to close all the brothels.
Yes,
He sort of scrutinised the police on that. So that's why he became interested in the area. And he's gay, so it's not out of a... It's the assumption that Tory politicians...
I know,
it's
awkward, isn't it? But also it's the difficulty with politicians in general, is if someone stood up for, say, decriminalisation, it looks like because I want to buy women.
Yeah, exactly, that's the assumption.
Yeah.
But so we went on a bit of a tour, and I was very uncomfortable because I'm, you know, not naturally the biggest fan of police. So in a police van around this area, and the stories I'd heard before they brought this managed area in was that sex workers would literally run away from the police. If they saw a police incoming, they'd run away.
Yeah.
Because the police were so kind of aggressive with their enforcement of the law. So we were there, and the police officer, who was like a, you know, 35-year-old bloke, there was a woman we approached in this van, and she was stood on the street corner. And he won't wind down the window, and he was like, oh, hiya, love. And she was like, oh, hi. And she came over, and he was like, oh, I'm just checking. He didn't take a name, but he was just noting the number of sex workers who were out. I don't know why, but it was just a parole. And in quite a short time, the numbers of sex workers, because National Anonymous was a reporting mechanism, so sex workers were assaulted, they could report it to us, and we'd support them, but we'd also warn other sex workers. Yes. That was kind of the system.
Yeah.
And in Leeds, in that part of Leeds, well, in the whole of Leeds, the numbers of sex workers reporting to the police before this managed area happened was something like 2%. It was really low.
Wow.
So 2% of sex workers who were, you know, but most of the time it was violence or sexual violence would report to police. But within like 6 months to a year of the managed area being introduced, 50% of sex workers were reporting crime to the police.
Because suddenly there was someone to complain to.
Yeah, there was a trust.
Yes, they thought something might happen or someone else might be protected. Also, the people who commit violence against sex workers, they commit violence in other areas of their lives. So that's the thing with, I think there's this misunderstanding, and maybe willful or not, from the police, of going, well, this is all just crime. These are just criminals against each other. And it's not that. They're not good people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And there's that one of the sort of textbook killers is the Green River Killer. Who's...
Yes. The Green River Killer we're referring to here is a man called Gary Ridgway. He's still in prison. He killed nearly 50 women and girls in the 80s and 90s in the state of Washington.
He admitted in the end to murdering 71 people,
so
but he lost
many.
Count. As if you lose
Yeah, he did
count.
Lose count. He was a weird guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, like totally. Yeah. And he started on sex workers and then he said...
Yeah, well, also, that's a misunderstanding. So I love... I shouldn't say love. Fascinated with serial killers. Mm. And obviously lots of serial killers
true
have
crime.
A sexual motivations.
Yeah.
And for a long time, there's this misunderstanding that they were killing prostitutes because they hated prostitutes.
Yeah.
Or their mum must have been a prostitute, or they hate sexual women. And it's just easy access.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a vulnerability thing.
Yeah, totally.
I found that so interesting. And also the reporting of crimes against women who sell sex, whether that's you've sold sex once at university or, you know, you're an escort in Japan or hostess, all these kind of things. The reporting of women who sell sex, and men who sell sex, actually. I think the word that's... like rent boy, the way that that's used by the press.
Yeah, totally.
So dehumanising the language. You didn't kill a person.
No, I know, exactly.
You didn't kill someone's mum or someone's brother. You killed
her. Yeah, like if somebody works in Tesco got killed, they wouldn't say like...
Yeah. Yeah, a trolley dolly.
Yeah.
I know that's not what we call people who work in Tesco's either. But yeah, absolutely.
That actually reminds
typist.
Me.
Useless typist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That reminds me that you asked a question about male sex when I didn't answer it.
Yes, so we'll circle back to that.
Yeah, so the, like we did, there's been loads of attempts to estimate numbers of sex workers, which is really hard for all the reasons.
I guess people want statistics for so many reasons, don't they? But I've found it really important because I keep talking about it like it's male customers and female selling sex, which is just to ignore a huge swathe of the people who are doing it. Yeah,
I mean, like there was a study and on female clients of sex workers.
Yeah,
And there is a little bit of like female client sex tourism.
Yes.
So British women go into
yes.
other countries.
I think Stacey Dooley did a documentary yeah. about, and I was, I found it, I mean, it's exactly the same power dynamics that make you uncomfortable about yeah. Lots of sex work, because these women were absolutely going over there because to pay for young black men.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But in terms of female clients in the UK, there isn't much evidence. There's been one or two studies, one not that long ago, but they haven't found that many women yes. willing to participate yeah. as clients. Mm. Could be because it's really taboo for women to do that, but I think also there are fewer women doing it. I don't know.
I think sometimes people presume with female sexuality, like, oh, it's because society says they mustn't.
Yeah.
But sometimes, speaking as a woman, the idea, what's sexy about a sexual interaction is being desired
yeah.
and there's something about paying for it which instantly makes it unsexy.
Totally.
Which is not to say that I'm speaking on behalf of all women.
No.
But that's why, for me, it wouldn't be like, oh, the shame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I couldn't kind of imagine. Me as a gay man is my view
yes,
is that
yeah.
I would need to be desired. Sounds
yeah,
terrible.
Yes. But I think that must be true of quite a, when I read like the Reddit threads or the Punternet. So similarly, like actually with the Secret Diary of a Cool Girl, the kind of the myth around it for some people. But there are some men who watch Pretty Woman
yeah.
and actually what they're getting off on is number one, so obviously they're getting off on the fact that they are the powerful person in the transaction, yeah. but also this kind of desire that deep down she yeah. might actually love him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like him back. And men who obviously form intense relationships or want to yeah. save in inverted commas.
Yeah, I think there's that kind of savior thing
yeah.
as well. But in terms of like male sex workers and male clients, which I think is probably...
yeah.
the law, when a man is a sex worker,
yes.
most of their clients are male still.
Yeah.
Some estimates are like about 10% of sex work is male sex
yeah.
workers, but there are, I think there's only one male brothel in London.
Oh, is there a
which,
male brothel?
Which it's mostly Brazilian guys, mostly gay.
Yes.
They're kind of very above board in the
yeah.
sense that, I've not been, but I know friends who've done outreach there, who like sexual health outreach.
Yes.
And it's, like they're very known, they're very public, you know, the police know of them, you know, because they don't do anything that's other kinds of criminality, you
yes.
know, but it is definitely a brothel.
Yeah.
They kind of ignore it.
Okay.
And it's been very kind of well-run establishment for years.
Mm.
And then, but there are pockets of male sort of street sex work, which is survival sex.
Yes. Yeah.
And some of it is, I hate the term, but like
yeah.
gay for pay. It's like straight guys who realise,
yes.
like you say in the book, that, what is it, 80% of homeless people are men.
Mm.
But obviously most street sex workers are female.
Yeah.
And it might be that women, you know, go into survival sex.
Yes.
So that's why they're not homeless.
Or even kind of, I was talking to others about this, but like there are some kind of like, relationships which might be societally
yeah.
acceptable but are still economic.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like normally when people talk about pimps, they think of this kind of American gangster type person.
Yeah.
Like you see in one of my favourite movies is True Romance, but
yes.
Like the have you seen that film?
No, I haven't.
Gary Oldman
no.
plays obviously a white guy playing a pimp who behaves like a black guy.
Okay.
It's very problematic on many levels.
Yes.
But it's quite
yeah.
a good film. It's got Patricia Arquette,
yes.
who's a sex worker in it.
Yeah. Okay.
But definitely recommend it. But yeah, like this kind of, you know, stereotypical pimp. But most of it is like basically a controlling relationship that is like they're a couple.
Yeah.
And it's not like that one guy will have like five or six sex workers.
No.
It's just like he is as a homeless guy, can't make money from sex work. So they'll have this kind of codependent relationship where he'll kind of pretend to sort of look after her a bit and
yes.
decide which clients she can see.
Yeah.
And she'll split the money.
Yeah.
Another thing about one thing I was going to say about male escorts, well, male sex workers,
yes.
is a lot of male sex workers are what you might think of as more high end. So,
yes.
you know, that
yeah.
term that people use.
Yeah.
And
so, so by that, what we mean is the kind of, they have autonomy, they have often more money.
Yeah.
So they've got somewhere to live and
yeah, yeah. I think because there aren't many male brothels
yeah.
and there are pockets of male street sex work
yes.
Throughout the country. Manchester's got a bit of a male street
okay.
sex work scene.
Yeah.
London's hasn't as much anymore, but partly because you probably can't afford to live in London if you need to
yeah.
engage in survival
yeah.
sex, or at least that might be a factor.
Yeah.
But there's yeah, so if you went on like one of the big male escort websites like Sleepy Boys is the
okay.
big one. I don't know if I'm supposed to. I'm not recommending.
Yes,
them to
this
say
is this is not an advert. But it's a funny name. Is it Sleepy Boys?
Yeah, and I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah,
and, that will have like a few hundred, maybe a few thousand.
And in terms of the service, in terms of like experience of violence and all those kind of things, would you say that's the same? Or are there different problems in terms of...
It's probably similar to, I'd say, less frequency.
Yeah.
But it also, like, I've done a little bit of work professionally with male survivors of rape, so not specifically sex workers.
Yes.
So obviously there's, like, a massive underreport in there anyway. Yeah. So we did at National Women's deal with a few cases where men and male escorts were raped.
Yeah.
Sometimes they were, like, lured by homophobes, for example. Not necessarily rape, but attacked.
Yes.
So there's things like that. But generally, I'd say it's less frequent than with women. And I guess it's just the sort of physical power dynamic.
Yes,
But most male... I sort of say this with caution in that, like, most, because I know, you know, I got to know quite a lot of sex workers when I was running National Ugly Mugs. And most of the male sex workers that I kind of know on a personal level, not all, but are a bit more sex positive.
Yes.
As in, they, like, one friend who's quite a high profile male escort called Josh Brandon. I don't know if you came across his.
No.
He was in the Daily Mail or something, is like, you know, the escort who charges £2,000 an hour, so he doesn't know.
Okay, brilliant. Just,
massively exaggerated.
Yeah.
But for him, it was like, it kind of interacted with being, he's kind of Welsh from a small Welsh town, being a gay guy who wanted to go to the bright lights of the city.
Yes.
And that was his kind of get out. I know it sounds sad. And he got a lot of stick in the media because he said it was either doing that or like working in Tesco or something, which sounds dismissive.
Well, but that's just where the nature of choice comes in, because that's an educated decision. It's going, I'd rather do that with my body than that with my body. And I think this is where... There's a very interesting debate around it, because in a way that's a princess story.
Yeah,
going, I didn't want this,
totally,
and so I chose to do this instead. And that for someone might be marrying a member of the royal family. You're still going to have sex with them.
Yeah,
but you get everything around it, and you go, we'll do it.
Yeah,
we'll
totally,
put up with it for that. I think like historically, marriage has. If you don't have other financial options, if some people in society have money and you have none.
Yeah.
There's, for women, the way it was to legally attach yourself to them.
Yeah, like Pride and Prejudice, as you
said.
Like, it's like,
we
like
just romanticise one version of it, and the other version, which is actually much more matter of fact of, I get paid per lay.
Yeah, exactly. And like most, like my sister, for example, this is no judgment whatsoever, but, you know, when she had kids, her and her husband kind of probably earn about the same amount.
Yeah.
But it was just assumed that she would... assumed by both parties that she would quit work and look after the kids, and she's never worked since.
Yeah.
And I don't really know if she's totally happy with that arrangement, but
it must be so boring.
Yeah, I know, that's right.
I can't help but judge, and I don't have children, so it's not fair, and I'm not married, but I just think, do you know what? Probably like someone with a strong bias would judge a sex worker saying, I'm actually happy with my decisions, thank you.
Yeah.
And you know how people go, well... are you really? Yeah. Like, how could you be? I think that about women at home with the kids. Even if they were like, no, I'm so fulfilled, I think, yeah, come on. That's your public face.
Yeah.
Like, it just must be so boring.
That's what I kind of think.
But it does link in, the two things link in, so like our expectations of men in society, doesn't it? Because if a man's identity, a lot of it's to do with providing and work and stimulation and existing outside of the home at the same time. So a man who experiences rape, he might have never ever have heard of that happening to another person.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not part of the narrative. The underreporting, the real sadness is because we don't as a society know how to deal with it. And we hear a lot, which isn't to in any way go, it's any easier. We hear a lot about the rape of women, and we don't hear anything about the rape of men.
And it is like the organisation. I used to be a trustee of Survivors Manchester, which is kind of...
I've done a gig for them.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I think I knew about that.
Yeah,
actually,
we did one, and it was... they just seemed amazing. They were supporting one of my friends.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And part of their role is obviously offering therapeutic counselling and all that, but like the other part, which is massive, is just saying, look, men get raped.
Yeah.
You know, simple as that.
They do, and we can't deal with it as a society. We have all of the same kind of questions that we do about women, but like, surely you could have like all of the same kind of wrong assumptions, and then not knowing how to deal with the process afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I guess now with like Jimmy Savile, for example, a lot of people sort of don't sort of compute this, but he also did abuse males.
Yeah.
I think there was only a very small proportion. Mm. And obviously with Kevin Spacey's accusations.
We have to say accusations at the time, although.
And so I guess stuff like that is bringing it to the fore more.
Yeah, but that's the thing actually, because lots of paedophiles who've preyed on, so boys.
Yeah.
So paedophiles who prey on boys, I think we talk about that slightly more culturally, but the fact that they're children is then their kind of their vulnerability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But what's so interesting about the Kevin Spacey allegations is it's exactly the same. It shows exactly the same power dynamic that's there with all abusers.
Yeah.
Which is that you can, because of what you have to offer, put people into vulnerable positions, and then that very gradual like pushing of boundaries
And gosh, yeah. I obviously used to work in the House of Commons.
Yes.
I had two spells of working in the House of Commons. And that is just a hotbed of sexual misconduct.
Shall we set fire to it? Yeah, shall we totally just burn it down?
I mean, it's going to fall down of its own accord.
That's
anyway,
true, isn't it? Yeah, the building's burning down. But let's make sure they're all in there having a big meeting.
Yeah, and that's like the worst power dynamics. And I'm sure in your world as a comedian, you've experienced this where people are just dying to get on the ladder in some way.
It's really fascinating because you are all of these jobs where you've got people at the bottom knowing what you get if you can get slightly higher, and then there are just people who can prey on those people by offering you a little bit closer. And it's the Harvey Weinstein format, but it is always it's horrible to think about it going on in politics, but of course it is.
I mean, it's just, I think there was this Radio 4 documentary that I took part in anonymously.
Yeah.
Which was taught, it did research around kind of parliamentary researchers and interns.
Yes.
And how many had experienced unwanted advances, and then it obviously escalated into actual, sexual assaults. And it was just a huge proportion. And actually, quite a lot of men as well. I think it was almost the same number of men as women, because there's a lot of like repressed gays.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, we might have talked about this before. I can't actually remember if I put it in my book, but you know Veep, which is such a great show, but they had a storyline through one series where one of the interns or someone lower down was getting sexually assaulted by a man, but it was dealt with very comedically.
Right, okay.
As in, they thought it was really funny that this man was having his balls groped.
Right, okay.
And I find it really odd. You know when something, you know like how you can, it's just blind spots. So they would never, ever have had a storyline where a woman was having her tits groped, and everyone was like, "Oh my god, so and so's complaining about getting her tits groped."
Like maybe in the '80s they would. But
yeah, that's Jim the thing. Yeah, it would have happened. Yeah, Benny Hill's chasing him around a tree. and it was just so odd because the idea of, I guess because he was seen as not vulnerable, there was nothing wrong. The storyline has this guy wanting to take him to a tribunal, and the comedy is him having to describe his balls being groped. Yeah, I just found it so astonishing that we go, okay, no sympathy for that person.
I mean, like women obviously experience it in workplaces much more than men do, and it's great that we're now at a place where that isn't okay to joke about. But I guess it'd be good also if any kind of sexual.
But there still is a thing where certain complaints are just dismissed as in, well, it used to be said a lot more about some of the stuff that women would experience, which is that's just part of the job.
Yeah. And I had a friend who I went to uni with who became a banker.
Mm.
And she was kind of, I mean, she was obviously super smart.
Yeah.
But like the same as most of our group, really. And I kept in touch. I'm not really in touch with her now, but I kept in touch with her for a few years after graduation and stuff. And she basically said the reason why I earn whatever 200 grand a year as a banker is because the way I look, and they like the clients to, you know, they send me off to deal with the client, the male clients.
And so there was just an acknowledged awareness of
which is really horrible and sad. And
it's just a bit disappointing, isn't it? That's the thing. And some people. I just read this book called The King Kong Theory. Have you read it?
No, I haven't actually.
You'd really like it. It's quite short. It's written by a French woman. And she describes her rape. And she was raped as a teenager. And it's really interesting because I think she's had a very similar experiences where all of your alarm bells go off like 5 minutes before, but you tell yourself you're fine.
Right,
so they got into a car. And it must happen so often or it must be something that people who have to sell sex, especially if they have to make a very quick judgment, learn to really trust.
Yeah, totally.
Is that there's certain things where your body picks up first, something's not right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, definitely.
And she spent 5 minutes going, you're being sick, like you tell yourself. No, no, you're absolutely fine, or you're being ridiculous, or... but anyway, she also talks about her experience as a sex worker and her experience of porn, but the very end is about how women who are acceptable to men are the only women who get kind of supported by the patriarchy. Yeah. So it's really interesting for me because I do panel shows and there's certain women who get employed and certain women who don't.
Oh, right.
And it's basically, and it's really true, sitting there looking a little bit pretty, not questioning the status quo, you make yourself employable and then you end up going, oh, I see. And then that's what they mean about being kind of... Yeah, and the minute if you were to say this, she talks a lot, this woman, Virginie, about ugliness as a kind of anarchy.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. It sounds really good.
Yeah, it's really, really great. It's really confronting in a great way, the stuff that she says. What got us onto that? So I was going to ask you a question. So when you were working with National Ugly Mugs, if you ever met somebody, you know, just like at a dinner party and they asked what you did, like what's the most common misconceptions that people make?
Oh, God. Well, people would be like, well, I mean, you would get people in a way, roundabout way, saying, well, you know, they sort of deserve it. They sort of bring it on themselves.
Yeah.
Which is awful and just kind of ruined the dinner party a bit because I wouldn't just be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, there is that point of view.
Yeah.
Because obviously I didn't agree with that.
Yeah.
You'd get people who, I mean, one of the big misconceptions is that it's just all illegal.
Yeah.
People don't understand the UK law.
Yeah, well, I don't. And I keep having to get it explained to me over and over again.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I think, yeah, and also then what you realise is you've heard very conflicting points about what would be better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't know if you recently, there were two, I think it was two women arrested in Northern Ireland because they brought in the sex by law, as they call it, sort of the Swedish approach.
Yes.
In Northern Ireland about a few years ago. And that kind of, that's kind of the approach that Julie Bindle and
so that, there's a big kind of feminist push. So the Nordic model and sort of Sweden and Northern Ireland is that it's not illegal to sell sex, but to buy it is illegal.
Yeah.
And the idea, so at the nub, when someone kind of passionately tells you it's a better idea, they go, well, we're not going to punish these women because they're very desperate.
Yeah.
This is how they make money. But we're not going to tell men it's okay to buy women's bodies.
Yeah.
And so, ideologically, you go, well, absolutely, completely right.
Right.
But obviously there's problems that come with that.
Yeah, and like the main, I mean, there's a few. I think, first of all, I think a lot of the people, this is maybe slightly controversial, a lot of the people who are advocating for that are a little bit disingenuous about...
Yeah.
About... Maybe their aims, because I do think, and from, you know, reading all the research and all the different areas, all the kind of public statements, having loads of debates, that I do think there's a sense that we hate these men who are buyers.
Yes.
And I'm not saying I like them.
No, yeah.
You know, I have sort of neutral opinion at best. Mm. And we want to punish them.
Yes.
And if sex workers who continue to be sex workers... are kind of collateral damage in that, then that's sort of okay. And I think that's really, really sad. And I mean,
because it doesn't have their needs at heart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I think when we're talking about sex, we really need to think of sex workers. We don't. I mean, the clients, we can have opinions. We can.
Yeah.
If legislating to stop the clients doing something massively harms the sex workers, then you know. Then it's just not helpful.
Because that's the thing that was then explained to me was that whenever you make it more difficult or dangerous for someone to buy sex legitimately, you make the car park darker.
Yeah.
You make you actually make the person selling the sex more vulnerable. They have perhaps less time to research. The thing with foster incest are taking things offline, where you can't now screen people online or email them, Skype them beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it sounds kind of a bit horrible, but essentially in that model, a sex worker's body becomes a crime scene, you know?
Yeah. So a crime is committed upon them.
Yeah. So they are evidence.
Yes.
Because it's weird. It's really not the crime on them. It's like the crime on the state. Them, you know, it's not like...
Yes.
It's not like they're the victim of a crime the way it's caricatured.
Yes.
It's just simply, it's a
crime.
Oh,
I see. The way that it's all kind of written together is, it is a crime on the state for you to pay for sex with that person.
Yeah, exactly.
But not upon that person.
Yeah, really. It's not the same. Well, I mean, I suppose it's kind of semantics, really. But like, it's not like, so they would have to give evidence, you know. But the other, the main kind of practical thing, well, the two things, let's say, is one, as you said, if you criminalise the clients, sex workers are going to go where the clients are.
Yeah. They're gonna, and the clients are going to make more of effort to kind of make sure they can't be in trouble.
Yeah,
so they're going to fake names, fake... it's sort of like you can just use your credit card and you go, that's definitely so-and-so.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Speedier transactions. Mm. You know, literally in Sweden, you'd have clients trying to make transactions in like 5 minutes, which obviously is much less safe.
Yes.
Sexual health, all the other factors. So that's one thing, like pushing sex workers underground and undermining their natural instincts of, you know, safety kind of mechanisms.
Also, I guess culturally, it still keeps that morality that it's a very wrong thing to do. So it doesn't do anything to lessen stigma.
Yeah.
I guess what you do is you create a picture of like desperation from the seller and depravity from the buyer.
Exactly.
And that doesn't actually go, oh, now they're a really good part of our, big part of our society and we realise they're people.
Yeah. And then another thing is none of those, because those legislations sees the sex worker who works with her sex worker friend indoors, that's a brothel, and they're both exploiters of each other, essentially.
Yes.
They don't, none of these proposals try and say, actually, if three sex workers work together, we're not going to prosecute
them. Even
with
that, so even with the Nordic, people can't work together.
Yeah, people can't work together. And most of the time, when sex work in this country and in other countries, when sex workers are prosecuted, when people are prosecuted for like brothel keeping type laws, it's sex workers working together.
Yes.
Because it's most, I mean, sometimes there is this like controller, but most of the time it's far more nuanced. There's like two or three sex workers working together. They might have a security person who's hired. They might have a driver who's hired.
Yeah.
They might have a maid who's hired. But none of those are more powerful in that dynamic than the sex workers.
Yeah, but they're all committing a crime by working together.
They're all committing a crime, yeah. So two, I think last week or the week before, two sex workers in Northern Ireland were arrested for brothel keeping.
Right.
And it was because they were working together.
Okay.
And it's another example of that law being used.
And in terms of like going to prison, that's a lengthy sentence, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's not a kind of a slap on the wrist. People can go to prison for years, technically.
Can be, yeah. And in fact, one of my friends, it's actually, I think her story features in the ECP research that we were talking about earlier, about kind of working conditions. She went to drama school and she wanted to work in kind of theatre and education.
Yeah.
And while, because obviously drama school is quite expensive and not all universities, but she did some sex work while she was at drama school.
Oh, yeah.
And she was working in a brothel with one or two friends.
Mm.
The brothel was raided and she was essentially convicted of brothel keeping.
Oh.
And she was just one of the work, you know, she was just, it was like a cooperative, really.
Yeah.
And I think the evidence they use, this, if my memory serves me well, is that she'd like sent text messages to a friend like, oh, can you pick up bog roll and things like that. It was like really kind of mundane things to say, look, you are a controller in this situation. So she didn't go to prison, as far as I know, but she was convicted and she's basically on the, you know, she's almost, it's like a, almost like a sexual
offence. So she's got a criminal record.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone was explaining to me in a different, one of the podcasts that, when you've got a criminal record, sometimes it'll say sexual deviancy or sexual crime.
Yeah,
rather,
exactly.
Yeah.
So she can't now work in theatre and education. So it's almost
she can't work with children ever, I guess, which is,
So she's kind of, you know, if she ever, if sex work was a temporary thing for her, it now isn't.
Yes, of course. And that's the thing. I didn't realise, I was reading that in America, you're not technically not allowed to go into America if you've sold sex in the last 10 years.
Oh, really? Is that I didn't even know that myself.
Yeah, you just find these things so surprising, but they must affect some people's lives. But that thing about being able to do jobs later on and then really restricting, we would see that as a breach of human rights.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
If that was a corporation that wasn't allowed to sell in a certain country because of you'd go, oh no, cause companies must be able to sell everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a company's right.
Yeah.
But yet when it's an individual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of one of the perversities of some of the laws that people put forward.
Yeah.
And another thing in Sweden, actually, is, and I don't know, this is more about how the law is put into practice.
Yeah.
But Sweden, it was done from a very... trying to eradicate sex work because sex work is inherently always violence against women.
Yeah, so that was the decision that was made, wasn't it? That there could,
you
couldn't have a person said it wasn't damaging to them.
Yeah, and not in any circumstances. And also there was an element of like kind of racism in the law as well, because most of the street sex workers at the time, which there weren't that many anyway, were African.
Yes.
And it was like, this is kind of visibly looks bad for us. You know, if you sort of scratch beneath the surface. And,
yes.
Jay Leave is an academic, who's a British academic, who's written well about this. It's really worth reading. But the other thing in Sweden was that the sex workers and the sort of state institutions, because obviously they've got like a really good healthcare system, weren't allowed to give sexual health, like condoms and outreach, to sex workers because that was seen as enabling sex work. So, and you actually had quite a few, you know, like senior health practitioners resigning because it was such a horrendous system.
Yes, okay. So actually, that there's something I only found out about, but I would be interested to get your opinion on it. So this thing, this double-sided sword of people who try to support or help people who are selling sex, then seeing as enablers, a situation where, obviously, as you've experienced completely kind of first-hand with people you've worked with, horrific things happen. Horrific things happen. So the idea that anyone is complicit because they are giving health services or condoms. And so this is what's interesting, what happened at the Brighton University. So I have to be very careful, actually, because I didn't know, but they're incredibly litigious.
The university are.
Yeah, what they did is a freshers' fair. And obviously anyone who has been to university will be aware of what they are. It's like the hockey team and the drama club and all this thing. And they had an organisation who support people who are selling sex. Now, students, as you mentioned with your friend, drama school.
Yeah.
For some people, it would be the most economically prohibitive time of their life.
Totally.
You eat terribly, very, very small food budget. Your life will be so impinged by the fact that you have all of these costs and very little time to earn money.
And you need for your studies.
Yes.
You need to not work too many hours.
Yeah, so that's it. You can't work a full-time job. No one would expect that of you to be able to also do a degree. So some people do sex work. Mm-hmm. And so this organisation who supports sex workers got a stall at the fair. And so in one sense, you think, what a sensible thing.
Yeah.
Because two things. It's saying to other people, don't judge people who choose to sell sex while they're studying.
Yeah.
And then you have the thing of you're saying to them, hey, know that we're here in Brighton if you ever have a problem.
Yeah.
And then there's backlash against it. Yeah.
And I think it's harm reduction. That's kind of the ethos that I live by in this area. But I can sort of see why people, the outcry was, because it's like people might walk past that stall and a light bulb might.
Well, yeah, because that's what you assume is someone's going, it hadn't even occurred to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I could, that's what they worry about is by saying there's less stigma around this thing, someone might go, okay, well then if it's legitimate or it should be more legitimate. Yeah,
and you know, like I as a gay man I went to university in Manchester, where obviously it's quite a thriving gay area. Transactional sex was reasonably common for even if it was just, you know, every now and then.
Yeah.
For me and people I knew, you know, like it could be just like, oh, I've nowhere to stay because I've lost my keys. Mm. So you might not be like you might not be arranging to have sex with a person. But you might say, oh, I'm going to sleep on your sofa. It might be strange. You might be getting in a cab with them. All that stuff. And I guess I don't know. It's hard for me to work out in my head whether I think someone working 14 hours to get paid 130 quid or whatever, I don't know what that would be. Maths isn't great. Compared to as a student, compared to someone working 1 hour and getting paid the same, the broader impact on their life, assuming that, you know, the clients were respectful, they didn't have bad experiences in sex work, they were kind of able to, you know.
Yeah, you can absolutely draw it up. But the one thing you can't do, the one thing that does complicate it is that, so even with a respectful client, and I don't know whether the pressure for this is always external or always internal or a balance, but say you had sex for money once, one person, not you, so say a person has sex for money once and they don't get into a violent situation, the person is respectful, but afterwards, because of how we treat sex as a society, and especially selling sex, they might have such inner turmoil about what does that make me and who am I and I'm now a person, and they might have future sexual experiences. It might be something they come to regret. Then also as a society, people have secrets because they feel like as a society, if you, again, like we talked earlier about with the murderers, everything about you is changed. Externally, we treat people because we have so few stories, narratives in the kind of mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so many sex workers I know, like sex workers who are journalists who sometimes write about sex work, or sex workers who are you know, well, in all walks of life,
yes,
don't feel they can speak out. I know someone who I knew as a sex worker and now is a local politician, you know, like...
And people live in fear of being, like, out, calling, coming out. Lots of sex workers don't want to, for completely understandable reasons. But then some people, they're, like, vulnerable to being blackmailed or bribed or just having a fear that one day someone goes, hang on, I know, you did this.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is, I guess that is one of the downsides. And it's, even if, like one of the arguments for decriminalisation is, like they have in New Zealand, is that... It tries to kind of educate society in a way that doesn't demonize people.
Yes.
But it's never gonna, it's not gonna click fingers and overnight.
No, I think there's so many very, very deep seated things, and I guess but that isn't something that reflects as much on the people who buy sex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the good things about New Zealand, just while we mention it, is they created additional kind of like systems, legal systems, in order to strengthen the sex workers' rights against the client.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's these things, I think they're called human rights courts, which are like sort of tribunals where if a sex worker has a third party, so it could be a security person or
like a receptionist,
like a landlord or receptionist, or, and sometimes there's a power imbalance, it could be a landlord or it could even be a manager. They can go to special courts, and last time I heard, it might have changed now, but all 100% of the cases that went before those like courts or equivalents found in favour of the sex worker and that like penalised in some way the third parties. So that's kind of adding an extra layer of
legitimacy.
Yeah.
And also, that they can complain, but I guess power, that is, it's redressing some of the power. It's saying if someone is infringing on your rights or abusing in some way, then there's somewhere to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who literally hear it and go, no, these are the rules.
Yeah.
And this is fairness.
My experience at National Women's was that, you know, we're dealing with people who had been, you know, treated in the most horrific way.
Yes.
All kinds of crimes, rape, etc. Who, and sometimes I would know, because the offender had been reported to us by other people, that this person is a real danger.
Yeah.
But they were still so scared to report to the police because they were a sex worker. And actually, because juries, because the CPS, because the criminal justice system.
Well, it goes back to what you say. If society is made up of people who, either through naivety, which is a nice way of saying ignorance, because ignorance sounds like a harsh judgment, but because of ignorance, because we don't talk about sex in general very much, we especially don't talk about this area of sex, say things to someone like you at a dinner party as well, they deserve it. That person knows that's how society feels. They knows that that's why they don't tell the other parents at the school what they do for a job,
all the
way down to, So I'm going to ask you now, I'm going to just check the time, and it might be my last question. I would like to ask you, in terms of like what we should all know more widely as a society, and that's quite a big thing, but what things do you just really wish everyone knew that we knew after we left school?
About sex work specifically?
Yeah, or just in this area.
In this area, I think, well, this is a real plug for your book, but there's so much, the first kind of what we would half, like the sort of evolutionary biology stuff, that was so useful. I learned so much. I was so I mean, I've been using as an excuse if I like fall asleep after sex with my boyfriend.
That's good.
It's just evolution.
Yeah, it is evolution.
Got fed up hearing that. But anyway, on a serious note, I think... with sex, I think it's, it sounds really cheesy, but it's that sex workers are, you know, mothers, brothers, sisters, fathers, sons, etc. And for as long as I can remember, you know, in all my professional life, probably 90% of policymakers, 90% of police officers, 90% of, activists who aren't sex workers... have an idea of what the law should be and what should happen without even listening to sex workers. And I think that's like the fundamental thing I've learned. And I until recently I was a Labour councillor.
Yeah.
So I've been a politician myself, didn't enjoy it very much. But that like if you can't do the basic thing of speaking to the people that what you're advocating for, who it affects, then I think that's kind of a real, I think it's really... well, it's just negligent, and I think it's
do you know what it is? It's a form of infantilization. It's like if a school doesn't listen to the pupils, or we know best, we're the teachers. That's how the power dynamic is set up, is that certain people, by their decisions, and because also I think the legal situation, are infantilized.
Like
the prisoners, like that kind of situation where you go, this is going to affect everything about their lives, and they're the one person who doesn't get an input into it.
And I think one thing that. Like, we all have views, especially issues about sex and money and power.
Yeah.
We all bring our own personal views. And one thing that I really liked about the book, another point, is that you kind of laid those on the table. Mm. But then, in a sense, you kind of almost went, you then went to academic research, people's experiences, and almost tried to undermine your own.
What I've been trying
views,
to do, and actually doing these podcasts and talking to people in more detail, even more excited about it, is like we have this first layer, which is like our emotional reaction, mm-hmm. and sometimes that can be attached to an intellectual reaction, so we connect the two. I feel this because I think this or I believe this, but that isn't the end. Like what you can then do is untangle why. So if someone just is listening to this going point blank, I think it's wrong that a man can pay to put his penis in a woman or a man, you go, I'm not saying you're wrong for thinking that, but it's not the end of the discussion about all of these human behaviours, and then the economics underlying them and the politics around it, is that it's not the end of the journey. And I just think, with sex, I do think there's inbuilt, as in evolutionary reasons, that we feel a need to police it or protect it.
Absolutely.
So I don't think it's just cultural, but I don't think that means that we then never do anything about it. Yeah.
And I had so many conversations during my time as CEO of National Limogs where I'd meet senior politicians across parties and we wouldn't really even be able to get beyond this is what my feeling and my instinct.
Yes.
And it was almost like they were saying, well, I find this icky, so we can't.
It's interesting.
About human rights.
Two of the women who I interviewed from the English Collection of Prostitutes at ECP had that exact thing of people just going, I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
And icky was the word that they used.
It's so weird.
Yeah. Whereas imagine if doctors were like, oh, it's bloody.
Yeah.
don't want to fix your heart. It's very bloody. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that.
Or
up chimneys or dusty. Yeah. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, and I just think it's kind of they're not serving their duty, really.
Yeah. So
I guess that's the one thing I'd like people to learn, that just listen to people.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends. Thank you so much to this week's guest, Alex Faze Bryce, and thank you so much to all of the people who've talked to me over the series of Sex, Power, Money. I have learned so much, and I really hope that you have found this interesting and eye-opening too, and perhaps you're now having discussions and debates around these topics in your own life. If you haven't read my book yet, Sex, Power, Money deals with a lot of the topics we've been discussing on the podcast, as well as looking at these kind of things from a biological point of view. I'd really love it if you read it. And if you like the podcast, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review to help other people find it. And I really hope in the future I'm able to do some more, because there are so many people I'd still love to hear from and talk to.